Jasper for sponsoring the this beautiful breakfast. I know that people didn't come just for the breakfast. They came to hear Rabbi Shaffer, but it enhances it. And we thank them very much. I want to thank Rabbi Malipsky and Mitch Rothstreich, who have been the coordinators for our very special speaking program this year and the holiday breakfast program. And you can see from the turnout that it's a very, very successful program. This morning we have tremendous host of having with us Rabbi Shai Shachtern, and I want to acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Brudny, the Rosh Kollel, the Mashgiach in Lakewood. It's a very big honor for us to have him here as well. I see Rabbi Shachtern every single day at the OU, so he's probably wondering what I'm talking about because he doesn't come to the OU on occasion, not every day. But there's the most amazing picture is Rebbetzin Shachter, Shai's mother, works at the OU for many years, and she has this amazing picture right next to her desk of her very illustrious and chashuv adam gadol, Rav Hershel Shachter, sitting and learning with Rav Shai. And you can see you can see in the picture the kedusha, that you see the shechina. It's an amazing picture, and Rav Shai is comes from a tremendous mishpacha, Rav Hershel and Rebbetzin Shachter, and he's the Rav of Young Israel of Woodmere. It's really a very, very special that he made the trek here on a holiday morning. It really is very special for us. He has a very distinguished bio. He is the rabbi of Yachad. And since the summer of 2017, he served as the rabbi of Karim Simcha, the Chai Lifeline, and he was formerly the assistant rabbi of the congregation Knesset Yisrael, the White Shul. He receives smicha from Rav Asher Weiss in Yerushalayim. He's a tremendous speaker. He's a terrific personality, wonderful Valmidos. And it's a very, very big schuss for us to have him speak this morning.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you. Vershus Demara de Asra. I want to thank Rabbi Luban. It's really a kavod gadol to be here in your shul, and thank you, Rabbi Malitsky. Thank you to all those who organized. It's an extra special kavod that the Rosh Kollel came, the Mashgiach. I'm sorry that I'm taking up your time this morning. And the only reason why the Rabbanim are here is to show kavod to the Torah, not anything to do with the speaker. It's because when we have an opportunity to come together to learn, we all take those opportunities and we cherish them. And the more people that learn together, the more of a kavod Torah it is. So I thank all of you for giving me this opportunity. I would have come even if there was a tremendous amount of traffic, and it's really a great schus and a great honor to be here. As we know, we're going through the Parshios now, when we have the experiences of Yaakov Avinu, and it's a very complicated journey. It's a very arduous task that Yaakov Avinu was given to go leave his parents' home, and as we read the story of Yaakov Avinu's dramatic leave from his parents' home, he goes to study, to learn in the Yeshiva Shei Me'eber for 14 years, and then he departs the yeshiva and settles into the home of Lavan. And we watch how a towering figure, one of the greatest of our avos, is on the run, and he's leaving a life that is replete with such honesty and virtue and remarkable integrity. And then he's going into the wilderness, and he's seeing a reality that is a very frightening world. And he engages Lavan for the first time. But before he gets there, obviously we're all familiar with the story. He falls asleep. That's where it all begins. And he has this unbelievable vision. He sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he sees the Ribbono Shel Olam standing above him, and he has this amazing image in his mind of what that represents and all that it's about. And as he wakes up, he responds by saying, Achein yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. I had no idea that this was a place that was so divine, that was so sanctified, that's so holy. Had I known, Rashi says, Ili yadati lo yashanti sham, I never would have gone to sleep there. How could a person go to sleep in such a place? But that is the story of Yaakov Avinu, and the Apter Rav suggests that perhaps what Yaakov Avinu meant here, when he said, Achein yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh, is he comes to a startling reality. And that reality is that I thought that the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu can only be found when one is in the spiritual epicenter of their lives. When I'm in my parents' home and I'm raised by Yitzchak, by Rivka, when I see spirituality all around me, when I'm in the Beis Medrash, when I'm in the Beis HaKnesses, that's where the Ribono Shel Olam, that's where God can be found. And what occurred to him for the first time in his life now, on this occasion, was that the Ribono Shel Olam can be found b'makom hazeh, b'makom hazeh, b'makom hazeh, wherever I am. Any place where I travel, any place where I go, every business that I'm involved in, every dealing that I have with another individual, every encounter and every interaction is always a place and an opportunity to find Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to be found and can be supplanted into this place. And that was the tremendous vision that he came to. And I always feel, whatever profession we might be in, and whatever job and whatever office and community we might work in, it's our task and it's our duty to remind ourselves that Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh, that the Ribono Shel Olam can be found on every click of our mouse, on every business dealing and every interaction, every encounter that we have and every engagement with anybody else is an opportunity for us to show and to bring the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu into that reality. And what greater way to remind ourselves of that than the day that we have off from whatever professions we might normally be busy with, and to show the Ribono Shel Olam that this is how we spend it. Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh, we have HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives, and this reflects what we think about all the time, throughout the year, throughout our busy days. It's just an opportunity to remind ourselves of what our challenge is, of what our opportunities are, and how much of a schus it is. What a great privilege we have, Ashreinu Matov Chalkeinu, how lucky we are that we have the opportunity to be close with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to study His Torah, and to all come together to learn it and to be uplifted as one. So we know that Hanukkah is coming, and it's an exciting time of the year. There's a whole lot to talk about, but this morning we only have an opportunity to talk about one shiur. Amir Toshem, you know, you should have the great schus over the next week to learn a lot of Torah and many different sugyas and different things. What I chose this morning to speak about is, the title is, The Most Difficult Mitzvah. And I think that that is a very presumptuous title. How can you say, how can you claim that you know what is the most impossible mitzvah? For some people, they're challenged with Shabbos, and other people are challenged with Kashrus, and some people find Taras HaMishpacha very complicated, and other people find Lashon Hara. There's a whole slew of mitzvahs, or Averos, that I would say are very complicated. So how can anyone ever dare say that they have identified what is the most impossible mitzvah to observe? I would never say such a thing if the Chasam Sofer did not identify it for us. And by way of introduction to today's shiur, the Chasam Sofer writes the following. Kal yamai ha'yisi mitzdar al amikra hazeh. Chasam Sofer writes that my entire life I was troubled, I was agonizing over this pasuk. What is this pasuk? Well, the Torah says, V'yisem nekiyim me'Hashem and le'Yisrael. We have an obligation to be virtuous in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be clean in the eyes of the Ribono Shel Olam, u'me Yisrael, and in the eyes of other human beings, in the eyes of other Jews as well. U'beis chov osei, the rights of the Chasam Sofer, these two responsibilities, these two obligations, these two expectations of being clean and virtuous in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as well as in the eyes of human beings, are something, he says, are shnei rofim tzmudim al gabenu. These are two weighty burdens that we hold on our backs, on our shoulders, at all times. And he writes, in my opinion, says the Chasam Sofer, Yoser Afshari Latzei Sidei Chov HaRishon, in some ways, he says, it's easier to be somebody who finds favor in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu than it is to be someone who is Yotzei Yedei HaBrius. After all, he says, we know that people have all kinds of wild imaginations. People have fantasies in their heads. And people assume and project all kinds of things about us that are the furthest thing from the truth. So how am I supposed to observe a mitzvah when I don't even have the capacity to observe it? I'm not in your head. How am I supposed to control the way you think about me? How can I control what anyone's perception of my behavior is? And writes the Chasam Sofer, when you have so many gossipers in the world, and you have so many people who just talk baselessly, and really have no foundation to what it is that they're saying, how can the Ribono Shel Olam expect of me, V'yisem nekiyim me'Hashem u'me'Yisrael? And he says, in my opinion, this is, in fact, the most difficult mitzvah. And as he writes, Ani her harti kam upon him, I wondered, he says, I speculate. Was there ever a person in the world who ever lived who was able to properly observe this mitzvah? That's an amazing statement. Was there anybody who ever lived who was able to do this properly? And in fact, he says, maybe that's what the pasuk means. Adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher ya'aseh tov lo yechta. There's nobody in the world who can live a perfect life. Look, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created all of us with a yetzer hara, and we all know that there are all kinds of temptations. Life is complicated. Life is difficult. We all have scenarios where we fail. That's the way it works, and that's why we have an opportunity of tshuva. But he says, what the pasuk means, tzadik, Adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher ya'aseh tov lo yechta, is perhaps a reference to this mitzvah of the Yisem Nikim Umei Hashem Umei Yisrael. So I thought that this is something that is worthy of our attention. Let's try to delve into the sugya. Let's try to understand this important topic as it's relevant and germane not only to every day of our lives. It's something that comes up all the time, but it's also particularly relevant to Chanukah, as we will see. So I handed out just a few mamakomas. You can follow along. We're going to say everything outside as well. And even though it's in Hebrew, we're going to translate everything, so you have nothing to be concerned about. The first question that one always needs to ask whenever engaging in any particular sugya in halacha is, are we dealing with something that is an issur d'oraisa, or are we dealing with something that is only an issur d'rabbanan? Is this rabbinic in nature? Is this biblical in its nature? It's important that we know that. Well, you'll ask yourself, why is it important to know that? After all, what's the difference? Whether the Ribbono Shel Olam himself instructed us to do this, or it's something that the Chachamim, that the Gemara told us later on, or the Shulchan Aruch tells us to do. Either way, I'm obligated to observe this mitzvah or not to violate this Aveira. So what's the difference? Well, there are many, many major differences in Halacha between Dinim D'Araisa and Dinim D'Rabbanan. Most prominently, the difference is, how does one approach a suffix? When I'm not sure, when I'm in doubt, am I violating this, am I not? Am I obligated to do this or not? In such a situation, it makes a difference. As we know, Safek d'araisa l'chumra, Safek d'rabbanan l'kula. If I'm dealing with something that is a biblical mitzvah, that is of biblical nature, I have to always err on the side of caution. I don't want to make a mistake and violate an issur d'araisa. On the other hand, if we're dealing with an issur d'rabbanan, we're a little bit more lax, we're a little bit more forgiving about that. So this is a major question, and we look at a Mishnah in Maseches Shkalim. So the Mishnah here in Maseches Shkalim is talking about the Torah Mesalishka. The Torah Mesalishka means, as we know, there was a mitzvah every year to give Machzis HaShekel. And they would drop it off in the Beis HaMikdash. That money was actually used to pay, to fund, all of the karbanos that were brought during the duration of the year. So the Machzis HaShekel all comes in. I would imagine you have millions and millions of coins that come into the Beis HaMikdash. Somebody has to be the accountant. Somebody has to go through the money and make sure that we have enough, make sure to count it up, make sure to bring it to the bank. So the Mishnah says there, Hanichnas Litrom Es Halishka. When you have that individual Kohen who is designated to go inside of that room and divvy up all the money and make sure that it's counted properly, the Mishnah tells us he has to take very serious precautions. We don't want anybody saying about him that maybe he pocketed some of the money. Look, there's a lot of money there, and we want to make sure that everything's above board. So, Eino Nichnas Lo B'Manol, he's not allowed to wear his shoes, he's not allowed to wear sandals, he can't have any pockets. Why? Because we're concerned that maybe somebody's going to think, somebody's going to accuse him of putting some of the money into his own garments, into his shoes, maybe stuffing it into somewhere in his clothing, and therefore we assume that he has to go above and beyond and make sure that nobody is going to have any suspicion, that nobody is going to presume anything. So much so, the Mishnah says, he's not even allowed to wear his tefillin. Can you imagine? He's not even allowed to wear his tefillin. Now, what do you think could possibly be in his tefillin? So, that's a fascinating assumption. Somebody might say that perhaps he opened up his tefillin and stuck a couple of coins in there on his way out of the Beis HaMikdash. Again, that's a very extreme fascination that somebody may have, an extreme idea that somebody would think of. I always thought it was extreme until a couple of years ago they had in the news that there was somebody who was traveling to or from Eretz Yisrael and they smuggled some drugs into their tefillin. And I said, I always thought this Mishnah was so unreasonable until you see, you know, if somebody really wants to smuggle something, I guess there are ways to do it even in your tefillin. So that's what the Mishnah writes here. And the Mishnah ends off by saying that we have an obligation, as the Pasuk says, Shane Emar, V'yisem Nikiyim Me'ashem Me'Yisrael, it quotes a Pasuk from Chumash, followed by a pasuk from Sefer Mishlei, Umatzachein b'seichal tov ve'enei Elokim ve'adam. That would seem to be an indication that this is actually a mitzvah midaraisa. After all, the Mishnah, when it introduces us to the concept, writes, Shedne emar, as it says in the pasuk. However, when you look a little bit further, you notice that many achronim assume that this is only a din derabbanan. This is something that is only rabbinic in its nature. It is not a mitzvah midaraisa. And even though the Mishnah here says Shana Emar, it's not to be taken literally. It is based off of that pasuk, but it is not an actual mitzvah midaraisa. And the truth is, this is really mentioned by one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, one of the great Rishonim, the Rush, lived in the 1200s. So the Rush, one of the Gedolim from Germany, writes, when we're talking about the Isser Dirabbanan, when the Gemara tells us that you're not allowed to carry a ladder on Yom Tov. So you'll say, what's wrong with carrying a ladder on Yom Tov? I'm allowed to carry a chair on Yom Tov. I'm allowed to carry a table on Yom Tov. Why should there be anything wrong with carrying a ladder? And the Gemara tells us the reason why is because there's a concern that somebody who observes me carrying a ladder is going to assume that I'm probably doing construction, which is not allowed to be done on Yom Tov. Somebody's going to assume I'm going to fix something in my house. And therefore, the Gemara tells us you're not allowed to carry around a ladder on Yom Tov, even though it's not really muktzah, even though, you know, I'm not really doing anything with it, but still, I would not be allowed to do it. When talking about that, Gemara and Beitza, the Rush comments that midrabbanan, that the Chachamim were the ones who instituted this whole concept, this whole idea of Maris Ha'ayin, that we have to be careful for the way people are going to judge us, for the conclusions they're going to come to. My father often tells the story. It's such a beautiful story about the Chafetz Chaim. It's a very famous story that the Chafetz Chaim was once on a train and there was somebody sitting somewhere close by to him. And this individual turns to the Chafetz Chaim and he says, where are you going? Where are you going? And he says, oh, I'm going to Radin. Why are you coming to Radin? He says, I want to visit the Chafetz Chaim. I want to get a bracha from him. So the Chafetz Chaim said, I don't know why you need to travel to Radin to meet the Chafetz Chaim. He's not as great as you think he is. And maybe you should find somewhere else to go. It's a beautiful story about the tremendous humility of the Chafetz Chaim and how he didn't take himself seriously, even though he was the undisputed Gadol HaDor at the time and for all times. And yet, the Chafetz Chaim didn't want to give off an impression that he was anything more than just a simpleton. He didn't want to tell him. And the story ends that basically this individual comes to Radin and he realizes that this is the person who he was sitting next to. He can't believe it. So it's a very, very beautiful story, and it just speaks to the incredible midos and the personality of who the Chafetz Chaim was. So my father often says that Reb Soloveitchik used to tell over the story, and he said it in great awe and deference to the Chafetz Chaim, but he said, al pi halacha, he doesn't think it's correct. Because he pointed out, again, with all the respect to the Chafetz Chaim, and it's a story in Midos regardless, it doesn't matter. But he said, if you think about it, the Mishnah here tells us that we have to be careful about how people think about us. What is their perception of us? So, Reb Soloveitchik felt that from there we learn that I'm not a balabas, I am not the owner of my reputation. You know, there are people who live life and say, I don't care what people think about me, let them say whatever they want, I'll do what I want, and I'm doing the right thing, and I don't care how they want to perceive what it is that I am doing. You don't have a right to say such a thing. You can't just say, I don't care what people say. You have to care what people say. And that's what you see from here. It makes a difference. Not that we need to live our lives based on the expectations of others, but we do need to care, and we do need to be mindful of the fact that whatever it is that we do might be interpreted by others, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, and that's something that we need to be aware of. So to damage my own reputation by saying, oh, you know, really the Chafetz Chaim is a nobody and he's a nothing, is something that's a beautiful midah, obviously, but when you talk about it in this context, it's a very interesting point to consider. So we have this idea, we have this concept, as we mentioned, of Maris Ha'ayin, which is really only midrabbanan. It's rabbinic in its very nature. Where in particular would there be a concern? When would you say we have to be worried? Is it only if somebody's going to interpret what I'm doing and assume that I'm violating an Isser D'Oraisa, a biblical command? Or would you say that even if someone's going to watch what I'm doing and they're going to think that I'm violating an Isser D'Rabbanan, that would also be a problem? I'll give you an example. The example would be as follows. We know the Gemara tells us that human milk is considered to be kosher. Obviously, many, many young children live and survive off of human milk. If it wasn't kosher, how would they be allowed to eat it, right? We're not supposed to give our children, even young children, non-kosher food. So it's considered to be kosher. And the Gemara says that were you to have a milk that was put into a container somewhere and put it in the fridge somewhere, that technically would be something that is permissible to drink. Who wants to drink it? I don't know. But that would be something that would be technically permissible to drink. So the Rashba, one of the great Rishonim from Barcelona, from Spain, the Rashba asks a very obvious question. And you look here, I think it's on there, right? The Rashba asks the question, and that is, Sha'alta, Basar b'chalav ishamahu. Well, you're telling me that human milk is considered to be a kosher item. But it's not milchiks. So would I be allowed to cook meat together with that milk? So what would you say? After all, says the Rashba, it's parif. It's parif, so I should be allowed to cook it. So the Rashba says, Kivin shechalav isha acha shapirish mutar, as we know, if you have it in a container, it is permissible to drink. Imkain ein baze iser klal. Or would you say, hey, somebody who watches me take a container of white liquid out of the fridge and pour it into a recipe that has meat in it is going to assume that I'm eating basar b'chalav, that I'm eating milk and meat together. So maybe, says the Rashba, I have to be concerned. And he comes to the conclusion that, in fact, you do have to be concerned, and that is quoted the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Pei Zayin in Yerodeah, where he says that you have to worry about the fact that the onlooker, that the bystander who's watching what's going on, is going to be confused. And they're going to assume that I'm eating basar b'chalav, that I'm eating milk and meat together, and that is a problem. The Rama then extends this a little bit further, and he says, well, maybe we can limit the scope of this problem, because he says, after all, what about chicken? The original prohibition in the Torah is eating meat and milk together. What about if I take it down a level? Instead of meat and milk, I have chicken and milk. So that, in fact, is only an Isur D'Rabbanan. So what if I take it down two notches and I have chalav shkedin? What if instead of having real milk, I have almond milk? We're all familiar with that. The stores sell it. So would I be allowed to cook with that kind of milk? Would I be allowed to use that in a meat recipe or perhaps not? And the Rama says that we have a practice that you would be allowed to use chalav shkedin. You'd be allowed to use almond milk if you were cooking Bisar Of, if you were cooking chicken. Because worst case scenario, you're only violating an Issur D'Rabbanan. Chicken and milk, chicken and real milk, would only be an Issur D'Rabbanan in the first place. So if I have chicken and fake milk, what's the worst thing that someone's going to think about me? That I'm violating an Issur D'Rabbanan, says the Rama. Okay, so that's not so bad, I don't have to worry about it. That's what he says. And the Shach there says, I don't understand, what's the difference? If the concern is that people are going to think that I'm violating an Avera, that I'm doing something wrong, why should it matter if they think I'm doing something that's biblically prohibited? Why should it matter if they think I'm doing something that is rabbinically prohibited? I'm not allowed to do something wrong. And what does it matter if the thing that everybody assumes I'm doing wrong is an Issur D'Oraisa or perhaps an Issur D'Rabbanan? It shouldn't matter at all. It's extremely relevant today because, as we know, we have coffee creamers and we have almond milk and we have all kinds of different supplements for milk itself. And it's a major question. I feel embarrassed to even talk about such topics in front of Rabbi Luban, who is the expert in all of these issues. But as we know, it's a major question. Are you allowed to serve that in the middle of a meat meal? After all, maybe somebody who walks in is going to say, hey, I once learned way back when that you're not allowed to have meat and milk. And even if they're not cooked together, you're not allowed to have them on the table at the same time. You're not allowed to drink a coffee with milk in it right after you have meat. You're supposed to wait 6 hours. So how could it be that I'm walking into this home and at the end of the meal they're offering everybody coffee and there happens to be a white liquid in the middle of the table? Now, we all know that that happens to be a supplement for milk. It's obviously not real milk. But would that be permissible or perhaps not is a very important issue. The question that you need to ask yourself is this a halacha? This idea of maris ayin, is this something that was frozen in time? Is this like you look at the Gemara and the Mishnayos and you find all of the scenarios that are outlined in the Mishnah and the Gemara, and those are the only things that are prohibited? Or do you say, no, we need to update this. We need to expand it based on the realities of our world today. And we need to think about everything that we do and consider how the onlooker is going to interpret what it is that we do. So it's a very serious question that you need to ask, because that really comes down to the crux of the issue that is nogea, that is important and relevant to us in our generation. So for this, we turn to Hilchos Pesach, and this is what is so beautiful about the Torah. The Torah is so magnificent that when you're talking about one topic that has to do with Maris Ha'ayin, Yerodeah, Basar B'Chalav, your kitchen, meat and milk, the way you're going to find an answer to that question is potentially from Hilchos Pesach, something that has nothing at all to do on face value with what it is that we're discussing. And it just shows the beauty, how everything comes together, and it's all relevant, and it's all important, and it's all part of one bigger picture to have a full and complete understanding of what the halacha tells us to do. So the Magen Avraham in Hilchos Pesach tells us an amusing story. He says, in Constantina, Nagu Israel Lasos Pashtil Lish, I don't know exactly how to say it, Olatagin Dagin Bimatza Afuya Mishum De Asila Achlufe. Writes the Magen Avraham that there were people who used to use matzah meal that was cooked, that was baked matzah already, and then they would crush it up and they would use it in some kind of recipe on Pesach. And he says that that was something that was frowned upon. Why? Because the concern was somebody's going to see and they're going to think that I'm using flour, they're going to think that I'm using chametz, and it's going to get all confused. And therefore he said, in my community, this is in the 1600s that Magen Avraham lived, so he says, in my community in Poland, this is something that we feel is inappropriate. You're not allowed to do that. And others, the Pri Chadash, also lived in the end of the 1600s, pointed out that, how can that be? I don't understand. We don't have the right to generate and to create... That's a train. I'm not sure if it's an earthquake. So, we don't have the right to generate and to create new institutions of Maris Ayin. The Chachamim told us what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do. You're going to come along and investigate every single action, every single little thing that a person's going to do today, and you're going to decide whether they're allowed to do it, they're not allowed to do it. It's enough. What the Chachamim told us is good enough, and it's inappropriate, the Pri Chadash argues, to be adding new ideas onto this old concept of Maris Ayin. Whatever it is, and we shouldn't be updating the halacha, which is a very important, a very fundamental locus here, because that really is relevant today. You have people who have business meetings in non-kosher restaurants. Again, there are so many shilas, so many problems, so many issues that we need to think about in the business world of today. And it's not simple at all, as we know, and so many different things come up. But a shila that people often ask is, am I allowed to go into the non-kosher restaurant? Well, what are people going to think? You go in with a yarmulke, you don't go in with a yarmulke. If you go in with a yarmulke, people are going to say, look, a religious Jew goes into a non-kosher restaurant, but maybe you'll say, we live in New York, we live in New Jersey, everybody knows that the Jews have business meetings, and everybody knows why they're going in, they're not going to eat anything, they're just going to have a drink. These are all very important questions, and you have to ask yourself, do I even have to be concerned about it? After all, Chazal didn't talk about McDonald's, right? Chazal did not talk about non-kosher restaurants. Chazal really were not aware of this whole reality that we have today. They didn't know what a business meeting was. Didn't exist back then. Didn't dawn on anybody that they would have the kind of circumstances that we have today, and far more complicated when you think about it more deeply. So this is a very, very important question. How is all of this relevant to Hanukkah? It's important and relevant to Hanukkah because the Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, Mitzvah Ner Chanukah is a mitzvah chaviva ad miyod. The Rambam says, as we know, the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is something that is so exciting. And it's not only exciting because of Chanukah gelt and Chanukah presents, it's exciting because we have an opportunity to celebrate by Yamim Mahayim Bazman Hazeh. We have an opportunity to point out and to highlight the great miracles that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for us, not only back then, but He continues to do for us. Adheina Azaruna Rachamecha We say it every Shabbos that we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the miracles that He's done for us in the past, for the miracles He continues to do, and for the miracles He will do in the future. And that's the opportunity that Hanukkah gives us. Lahodos u'lahalal, mitzvahs ner Hanukkah is such a beloved mitzvah. It's something that makes us so excited. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Shabbos, what if I have a home that has two different entrances on two different sides of the avenue? Two different sides of the street. So you have people who are going to pass by my house on this side, people are going to pass by on the other side, and there are two different access points to the home. So somebody who's driving by at 6 o'clock this Sunday evening is going to look at my windows and going to notice that there is no menorah. Now it just so happens they don't drive on the other side of the street, it's a one way the other way, so they're only going this way. And they don't know that my entire family has already lit the Hanukkah candles on the other side of the street. And anybody who's driving down on the other side is going to see the menorah. But everybody who's driving down on this side of the street is going to miss it. And they're going to assume that I, as much as I profess to be a religious Jew, I really am not as religious as I claim to be. After all, it is the first night of Hanukkah, and you are not lighting the candles. So we have to be concerned. And the Gemara says, because of Maris Ayin, because we're concerned that people are going to walk away and have the mistaken impression that I did not do my mitzvah of Neris Hanukkah, I have an obligation to light the Hanukkah candles on both sides of my house. I have to light a menorah on this side where people will see it. I have to light a menorah on the other side where people will see it as well, in order that if anybody passes by from either side of the house, they are going to have the opportunity to see that I lit the Neris Hanukkah, which leads the Beis HaLevi to ask what I think is a very amusing question. And it amazes me that nobody else asked this. The Beis HaLevi was a very recent achron. This is a question that should have been asked 1,000 years ago. And when I saw it in the Beis HaLevi, I was so surprised. Beis HaLevi says we have a halacha in Hilchos Chanukah. It's a big discussion in the Gemara. Kavsa zakukla or kavsa ein zakukla. The Gemara discusses, happens all the time, every year. People light Neres Chanukah. It actually used to happen more when we used to prepare our own wicks. There are still people who do that, right? You know, I feel there's something lacking, I'll be honest. I feel there's something lacking. I happen to be a big mafunak. I hate getting my hands dirty. But for a mitzvah, we should all be proud to get our hands dirty. After all, the Gemara tells the story about a Kohen who didn't like to get his hands dirty when he did the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash and he put the gloves on because he said, I don't want to get blood on my hands when I have to get all dirty, then I'm going to have to wash my hands off, maybe it's not going to come out, I have other things to do, I have a wedding to go to tonight. So the Gemara tells the story how he put gloves on and he was punished for that. You think you're too good for the mitzvah? You think that your hands are too holy? Just the other day I had the incredible schus, I don't know if they have it here in the neighborhood, but I had a great opportunity. I was invited to participate in an iShine event. I don't know if anybody knows what that is here. But iShine is a program that is run through Chai Lifeline. And it's such an amazing initiative. It's all volunteer work. People in the neighborhood who identify children whose parents are dealing with illness, either because a member of the family is undergoing treatment or because one of the parents is undergoing treatment and they're in and out of the hospitals. So they have an arrangement that every Monday and Wednesday these children get picked up from school by volunteers. They're brought to a certain location. They do homework with them. They give them dinner. They do an activity every Monday and Wednesday. And then they have a volunteer who drops them off back at home. And it's an opportunity to give the family a little bit of a reprieve. It's for children 5 to 12 years old. It's absolutely amazing. So they asked me to come this week to join them to see what's going on. I came there. I burst out crying. There are 25 of the 55 kids who are there who are Yisomim, who don't have parents. 25 kids from our neighborhood who don't have parents. It's just astounding. It's a staggering number of children. And the rest of them all have a member of the family who is undergoing some kind of treatment. And it was just amazing. So I was sitting there on the floor with a number of kids and painting with them. I was not told in advance that it was non-washable paint. So I got my suit all stained. And I said, I wore it to my shir that night in the shul. And I said, is there a greater badge of honor than to wear a suit that was stained by Yisumim, who I had the opportunity to sit with and paint Chanukah menorahs? I said, I couldn't be prouder. This is what suits are made for. This is what our clothing is made for. This is what our hands and knees are made for, to get that on the floor. You know, if it's not too much of an embarrassment for the Ribono Shel Olam to say about himself that he is an Avi Yisomim V'dayin Almanos, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu confined it within himself to be there for the Yasom and to get his hands dirty for the Almana, who is often overlooked, who is not paid enough attention to. If the Ribono Shel Olam can pride himself on that, I don't feel that any of us have the right to say that it's beneath us to get down on the floor and do such a thing. So I had that great schus, that great opportunity, and we were making menorahs and getting our hands dirty, and I said to the kids, you know, a lot of your family members will never know what it means to get their hands dirty for Chanukah. I said, you're not going to believe it, but when I grew up, and I'm not that old, I said, when I grew up, we actually had to pour the oil into the menorah. We had to make the wick, and it didn't light well, and then you had to take it out, try it with a toothpick, and try it with this. Finally, you realize you got to put your finger in there and get it dirty, but it didn't always light so well. And it was a discussion. These kids were looking at me. They said, what do you mean? What is a bottle of oil? They never heard of it. I said, you know, not everybody has the pop-off caps and the pre-made and the everything like that. So we're a blessed generation. I guess we're a spoiled generation where we have everything pre-made for us. I remember a couple of years ago, parenthetically, there was a woman who called me up. I don't know if you have Gourmet Glot here, but we have Gourmet Glot by us. They sell everything under the sun and more. So before Pesach, they sell, just to make sure that you don't have to work too hard, they sell a Bidikas Chametz kit with the 10 pre-wrapped pieces of chametz in a bag. So, you know, it's a little bit extreme. And I always want to stand there in the aisle and watch, who is going to buy that? Really? Who's going to buy that? So I remember there was a woman who called me up that she was going away for Chol HaMoed Pesach. She said she was going to a hotel. She asked me, what's the protocol? What are you supposed to do? I said, well, you have to do Bedikas Chametz. You don't know who was there before. It wasn't checked beforehand. You're not going to a kosher hotel. So you have to check it out. So she said, okay, great. So I'm going to go and buy the Bedikas Chametz Kid to bring along with me. So that on Pesach, I put it out. I said, no, that's by your rabbi, your matzah. You're not allowed to bring chametz into the house. So people get lost when, you know, when we have everything pre-made. You're not thinking. You're not realizing what it is that you're doing, what it is that we're supposed to be doing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu likes it when we do things, when we invest of ourselves, when we get our hands dirty for the mitzvah. Anyway, back in the days when we used to have to make our own wicks and ashrenu for the people that still bring themselves to do such a thing. So back in those days, the wick often didn't light the way it should. And often it went out, and you always had that question, do I have to relight it? It only lit for 2 minutes. So now it burns out, do I have to relight it or not? So the Gemara already has this question. This is an old problem. Kafsa zakukla, kafsa ein zakukla. Do I have an obligation to relight it, or do you say, no, I did my mitzvah, I made the bracha, I lit it, I did what I was supposed to do. And the Gemara comes to the conclusion, kafsa ein zakukla. And that's the way the Shulchan Aruch paskins. If I light the Hanukkah menorah and then it goes out, not because I blew it out, it goes out because, whatever, for whatever reason, it blows out, doesn't light well, I don't have to go back and light it once again. That is what the Shulchan Aruch paskins. So asks the Beis HaLevi, such an amazing question. The Gemara tells us here, if I have two sides of my house, and there's a window on this side, a window on the other side, I have to light on both sides to make sure that everybody knows with certainty that I'm doing the mitzvah that I'm supposed to be doing. Well, he asks, if that's the case, how do you explain this halacha and Shulchan Aruch? The halacha is, kafsa ein zafukla. If my candles go out, I don't have to light it again. Why don't I have to light it again? Somebody who walks by my house 10 minutes after candle lighting is going to wonder, hey, Schechter claims to be a religious Jew. I walk by his house on Hanukkah, and I can assure you there was no Hanukkah menorah lit. Why don't we have to be concerned of Maris Ayin? It's a fascinating question. And he comes to the end of the thing where he writes, the end of the paragraph, he says, I don't understand. How come nobody before me ever asked this question? The Beis HaLevi was a pretty contemporary sefer, and the question is, why wasn't this question asked 1,000 years before him? It's a fascinating shaila. And it reminds me of a discussion that the Nesivos, the Derech HaChaim Siddur, has, also about Neiros Chanukah, where he says, Rachmana Litzlan, what is the protocol when somebody loses a relative during any day of the year? So we know the Shiva, the Shloshim, the Ziyad Beis Chodesh for a parent, but we know that before the Shiva starts, before the Levaya, a person is considered to be in a state of aninus. And the Gemara says that an onen is pater min amitzus. An onen has no obligation to do mitzvahs. In fact, it's not clear. The Rishonim have different opinions, and in Shulchan Aruch it says different things, one in Arachaim, one in Yerodea, two different positions, lahalacha. Does an onen even have the right to volunteer to do a mitzvah if he wants to? So we are wired from a very young age to say a bracha every time we pick up food, we pick up a drink. We are wired to daven every day, to put on tefillin, and it's uncomfortable for us when we don't. And it feels strange when we don't do the mitzvahs as we normally would observe them. Now granted, I have a ptur, I'm given a pass because I'm supposed to be busy dealing with the funeral arrangements, dealing with the levaya, with the kavod ames, giving honor to that person who has deceased, who has passed away, but after all, if I want to make a bracha, or I want to put on tefillin, or I want to daven shacharis, do I have a right to volunteer? And it seems that Pesach and Shulchan Aruch seems to be, again, it's a discussion in the Rishonim, that I don't even have a right. I'm supposed to be solely and singularly focused on this. And I should not divert my attention to do anything else other than this. Everything I'm doing right now should be to give the kavod ames. And that leads us to a question. So what happens on Hanukkah? You have somebody, Rachmana Litzlan, is an onen on Hanukkah. Now obviously, they're going to be exempt from the mitzvah of Neiros Hanukkah. But how can you tell me that my house is not going to have a menorah? What about somebody who's going to walk by the house? They don't know, there's no sign on the door that says, unfortunately, this family has just lost a relative, and therefore, they're not observing mitzvahs. It doesn't say that. So how am I going to get around this problem? Oh, so another member of the family. What if you have a single person who lives by themselves? Happens, right? So another member of the family is the easiest thing to do. But what about if somebody lives alone? And they don't have another member of the family to light for them. Shouldn't we be concerned for Maris Ayin? Don't I have to be worried about that? And that is a very important question to think about. Again, when the Gemara introduces us to this concept of Maris Ayin when it comes to the Chanukah menorah, to the candles, I have to be worried about what the onlooker, what the bystander is going to think or say. How does that play out in different scenarios? How does it play out by Kafsa Ein Zakutla, when my candles burn out mistakenly? How does that play out, Rachmana Litzlan, God forbid, by a Avel, by Aninus? And how will it play out in other scenarios and other circumstances? It just so happens, it's interesting, that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in one of his svarim that potentially today, it's not the same as it was in the times of the Gemara. And this is a very hegyoni, it's a very understandable statement that he's making. And if you are familiar at all with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's works, you'll find very often he says things that are so logical, that make so much sense. Just, you think about the metzias, you think about the reality, and he points you to what really makes sense about the reality. So here he says, in the times of Chazal, there was no electric lighting. The Gemara makes reference to this in the beginning of Maseches Brachos. The Gemara tells us, when the sun went down, how much longer did people stay outside? So everybody came home. It's still light outside for a couple of minutes, a half an hour maximum, but after that, you can't be outside anymore. So everybody came home at the same time. Everybody lit Hanukkah candles at the same time because there was nothing else to do. There were no lights. A person would sit in their house and have dinner with the family and light a candle. But nobody was roaming around the streets outside. And he says, that made sense. When everybody lights Hanukkah candles at the same time, it makes sense to say that if you're the only one in the neighborhood that doesn't have a menorah lit, something looks a little fishy, something looks strange. But he says today, where everybody knows this guy has a wedding, and that family has a bar mitzvah tonight, and this one's flying to Eretz Yisrael for the week, and everybody's doing different things, and this one comes home late from work, and that one has to go out early. Everybody has different schedules. We're not all running on the same schedule, and we're all traveling, we're going different places. He says this whole concept of Maris Ayin when it comes to Chanukah may not be as relevant as it once was so many years and generations ago, because the whole way that we live life is so different than it was many, many years ago. Anyway, the Ran writes something very fascinating. And the Ran tells us, again, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim in the 1300s, the Ran says, if I have to light a second Hanukkah menorah because of Maris Ayin, again, I sat with my family, we lit the menorah, it's all wonderful, it looks great, but then I realize on the other side of the house, there are people who are going to pass by who are not going to see the menorah on this side. So I have to light the second one because of Maris Ayin, because people are going to think and suspect that maybe I didn't do the mitzvah. Says the Ran, would you say another bracha when you light there? All those in favor. What do you say? So the Ran says, you wouldn't make another bracha. You're not doing another mitzvah. The only reason why I'm lighting the second menorah is because I have gossipers in the neighborhood who think poorly about me, and therefore I need to light a second menorah. I'm not lighting it because God told me to light another menorah. I'm lighting it because I need to take away from the imagination of people in my neighborhood. And therefore I light a second menorah, but it's not an actual mitzvah of Neres Chanukah, and therefore the Ran says, you would not recite a second bracha. Which is similar to a psak of the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva, it's again, not at all at the same time as the Ran, 400 years later, the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva, that sometimes you have a child who has a bris milah, but then the child gains a lot of weight, and at some point it seems that somebody who would look would not notice that the bris milah was actually done properly. So we know that you have to sometimes, under certain circumstances, do some kind of incision again. Would you recite a bracha on that? The only reason you're doing it is mishum maris ayin, and you're only doing it because you don't want people to think that this person didn't have a bris milah. Of course they had a bris milah. 8 days old, they grew up in a religious home, of course they had one. And they are considered to be properly gemalt. And yet, later on, you may have to do this procedure. You would not recite a bracha, says the Chasam Sofer, because the only reason you're doing it is mishum maris ayin. The problem with that is, we have a fascinating sugya in halacha. How long are we supposed to go? What? Hey, I don't have to speak in my shul till tomorrow. So get comfortable, everybody. Okay, how about this? We'll make a deal. Anybody who has to leave, I won't feel uncomfortable. You can walk out at any time. So, amazing. So, there's a fascinating phenomenon that is discussed in the Gemara Maseches Chulin. It's referred to as a ben pakua. Ben pakua is something very strange. A ben pakua is a situation where you have an animal that's pregnant, and you end up shefting the mother animal, you do a proper shechita, and after you sheft it, you have a live animal that was inside of the mother. So the halacha is, the Gemara tells us, and the Shulchan Aruch paskens this way, the halacha is that the shechita that you did for the mother would actually count for this baby animal that was born. Now that's very strange. Why is it strange? Because the baby is running around. So how can it be that the shechita worked? The mother's dead, the child is alive. So what does it mean? So that's a big discussion in Achronim to explain what it's all about. What's the mechanics of this halacha? How could it be? How can it be that the mother's shechita works for the child? But either way, the Gemara then says, but if the child's then going to go roam around and be a part of my whole backyard camp that I have, my whole backyard farm that I'm running, and then one fine day I'm just going to be hungry and I'm going to make some kind of a holiday dinner and I'm just going to go to my backyard, take this animal without shefting it, just put it on the grill, everyone's going to look at me and say, this guy doesn't believe in shechita. I thought he was a religious Jew. I thought that he keeps kashrus. I thought that he always is careful to buy meat that was shefted properly. But it seems, I saw one day, I was watching, when in his backyard, he just took an animal out of the backyard, put it on the grill without shechita. How could it be? So the Gemara says that's a Maris Ayin issue. Although it's true that technically, when I did the shechita on the mother, it works for the child that later on was born. But the problem is going to be a technical one. Everybody sees this animal roaming around. Nobody knows the history of the animal. And therefore, the Gemara says, once it is running around in my backyard, I no longer have a right to rely on that shechita that was done of the mother. I now have to do an actual shechita for this baby animal as well. Mishum marasai. And there, here is the problem. The Rishonim write, the Rashba says, that when it comes to this issue of shechitas ben pakua, you have to make a bracha when you do the shechita. So just something to think about. Why is it that the Ran tells us, when I light the second Hanukkah candles because of Maris Ayin on the other side of my house, I don't make a bracha? It's not the mitzvah. I'm doing it only because people are going to look at me funny, so I have to make sure. Chasam Sofer writes, when it comes to Bris Mila, and you have to do another incision because someone's going to mistakenly think some individual didn't have a Bris Mila, I don't make a bracha. Because I'm not really doing a mitzvah bris milah. We did the bris milah already. Now I'm only doing it because I don't want anyone to think negatively. That's the way it seems. That seems to be the pattern. And suddenly, we have this monkey wrench here. Suddenly you have the Rashba who tells us that when it comes to a shechita of a ben pakua, the Gemara in Chulin, again, it's an unusual scenario. When I have that phenomenon, I have to make a bracha when I do the shechita. Why should that be the case? What's the difference? The only reason why I'm shefting it is because of Maris Ayin. And generally the rule seems to be that when you're confronted with an issue that's only Mishum Maris Ayin, you do not recite a bracha when doing so. There's an important Mishnah that we need to be aware of, and that is the Mishnah Maseches Kilayim, where the Mishnah tells us, as we know, there's an Isser of Shatnez. You're not allowed to wear a garment that has wool and linen woven in together. What if I have a garment that has silk and linen woven together? What would you say? Shouldn't be a problem. The Torah says, Semer upishtim yachdav, you're not allowed to have wool and linen. What if I have silk and wool? What would you say? Shouldn't be a problem. Why? Because after all, it's not wool and linen. And yet, you look at the Mishnah Maseches Kilayim, and the Mishnah tells us that since not everybody is familiar with the different fabrics, with different materials, you would not be allowed to weave silk and linen together. Because somebody is going to think that you're wearing shatnez. That's what the Mishnah says. Comes along the Rush, and he tells us a tremendous chiddush. And this is something very unusual, where you have a halacha that is quoted in the Mishnah without anybody who argues, and one of the Rishonim comes along hundreds of years later and undoes an entire halacha of the Mishnah. And just says, it doesn't apply anymore. Now the Rush was one of the greatest of the Rishonim, but yet the Rush tells us here, how can that be true? The Rush says, we live in an enlightened generation. We live in a generation where people are fully aware of the different materials. You look at somebody's shirt, you're not confused whether it's silk or it's cotton or linen. Everybody knows what silk is, and everybody knows what looks like cotton. So says the Rush, in our generation, the Rush, I believe, lived in Germany, and he says, I don't think anyone has any confusion anymore. And the Rush says, in my opinion, since everybody in the 1300s is fully familiar with all the different fabrics, and everybody knows what silk is, and what linen is, and what wool is, we no longer have to be concerned for this. And although the Mishnah tells us you're not allowed to weave a garment with wool and silk together because somebody's going to think that it looks like shatnez, that would no longer apply. That psak of the Rush is quoted the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, which means it's a very important halacha because it means that maris ha'ayin is dependent on a reasonable thought that somebody would have. Is there going to be one person in my neighborhood who's totally uneducated, who knows nothing about anything, who's not familiar with different articles of clothing, who really doesn't know the difference and is going to look at my shirt that is silk and wool and say, hey, Schefter's wearing shatnez? Yeah, there might be such a person, but says the Rush, on the whole, we are a generation that is very knowledgeable and we know the difference. And therefore, says the Rush, I don't have to worry about the one person who's going to have the mistaken impression, because after all, 99% of the community knows very well what it is that they're looking at. And therefore, what you see from this psak of the Rush is that it has to be a reasonable consideration that I'm worried about when we talk about this whole topic of maris ha'ayin, which leads to the final question. Let's bring ourselves back all the way to the first Mishnah that we began with. The Mishnah tells us, Hanichnas litrom es halishka. You have all the money that comes into the Beis HaMikdash. And you have somebody who's designated to count up the money to be the accountant. So it says he's not allowed to wear shoes, he can't have any pockets, he can't have anything that would make anybody think negatively about what he is doing. So much so, he's not even allowed to wear his tefillin. I ask you, if I have 100 people who watch this person come out, how many of the 100 people are going to suspect that maybe the Kohen, who is probably the most upstanding Kohen, otherwise we wouldn't have chosen him, we wouldn't have designated him for this job. So he's probably an upstanding individual, he's a wonderful person, has a great reputation. He's the one who just went in. How many people out of 100 are going to say, maybe he opened up his tefillin and he hid a couple of coins in there and that's why he made money later on. You see, he's making a simcha like this. Look, how can he afford that? Obviously, it's because he stole a couple of coins from the Beis HaMikdash. You tell me, how many reasonable people in the world would say such a thing? Maybe they'll say he stuffed his pockets. Okay, so he doesn't have pockets. Maybe they'll say he put it into his shoes. Okay, he doesn't have shoes. How many people are going to say, a meshugana, he opened up his tefillin inside of this room and he hid a few coins? It's so unrealistic. It's unreasonable. And when it comes to maris ha'ayin, we don't deal with unreasonable fantasies that people have. I don't have to be worried that someone's going to come up with some kind of conspiracy theory and assume that this happened, that, right? You listen to these conspiracy theories today and you see how far people's imaginations go. So do I have to worry about those people, says the Rush? No, because 90% of the people are very educated today. They know that this is not a concern. If that's the case, why does the Mishnah tell us that the one who is designated to be Torah Mas Halishka has to worry about this? It's so unreasonable. It's so extreme. And the improbable nature of this accusation is something that should make it that we don't have to be concerned about it. Why can't he wear his tefillin? So a number of years ago, I asked this question to Rav Asher Weiss in Yerushalayim. And he said such a profound response. It's so important because it sheds light on so many other aspects of life as well. He said, although it's true that when it comes to maris ha'ayin, we only have to worry about reasonable concerns. We don't have to worry about the conspiracy theorists. But when he said, when you're dealing with a person who's in a position where they hold the public confidence or the public trust, that person needs to go even to the most excessive, drastic, and extraordinary measures to make sure that they are living life in an above-board fashion, to make sure that not a single person who they interact with is ever going to have an accusation on them, even if it is the most far-fetched, the wildest imagination that somebody's going to have about them. You as the leader, you as the person in that position of authority, needs to understand the responsibility that you hold. And don't let people down. And even though, what did I do wrong? I'm just doing my job. I'm doing what I'm supposed to. Someone's going to be choshed my tefillin. The answer is, most regular people will not. But you can't be like most regular people. You need to live life a notch above regular people. You need to worry more than other people need to worry because the public has placed a confidence and a trust in you. And he brought a proof to this because the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma, there was a family of Kohanim who were the ones who were put in charge of making the Ketores. They knew how to crush up all the spices, they knew how to make the whole ingredients and put them together. And it says that their wives never wore perfume. Why aren't their wives allowed to wear perfume? What's wrong with wearing perfume? So the Gemara says, because someone might say they stole a little bit of the Ketores and they brought it home because they wanted their wives to smell nice. So their wives were never allowed to wear perfume. Really? Who's going to think I took Ketores home? Who do you think we put in charge of this job of being the one designated to make the Ketores? Probably wonderful Yidden, probably wonderful Jews, and yet someone's going to say that that's where his wife got the perfume from? The answer is, you're right. 99% of the people will never have such thoughts. But someone in a position of authority like that needs to understand and appreciate the responsibility that they hold and needs to live up to that expectation and needs to make sure that everything about the life that they live is so above board that there's nobody who can possibly ever have a negative thing to say about their kind of behavior. Let me close with a comment of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, where he says, you look and you contrast the Alanisim story that we say on Purim and the one that we recite on Hanukkah. And he says, if you look at the closing, the concluding statement of each one of Alanisim, you'll notice that when we come to the end of the story of Hanukkah, we say, and when we come to the conclusion, to the upshot of Purim, the closing statement is, and the truth is, says Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, you could have really switched that. On Purim, you could have ended off by saying, V'kavu, and they instituted that because of the great miracle of Purim, we have a day of celebration, Mishta v'simcha, v'yamtiv mishlach manas, we don't talk about that. And you could have said at the end of the story of Hanukkah that there was a war, and we won the war, and everything was great, but we don't talk about that. Why is it that we find this discrepancy? Explains Reb Shlomo Zalman, the answer is that we want to highlight in each occasion, on each instance, the focus and the feature of the miracle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did that completely torpedoed the idea of the enemy who was trying to destroy us. As we know on Purim, the enemy's attempt was Lahashmid Laharog Laabed, utter destruction, total liquidation of the Jewish people. And in response to that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu turned it around, Benahafachu, Bisalu Osobez Banavalaites. You tried to wipe, to eradicate the Jewish people off the face of the map. Bisalu Osobez Banavalaites. Haman and all of his family, Kain Yovdu Kala Rishayim. That's what happened to all of them. You want to know what happened on Hanukkah? On Hanukkah, there was a threat to our Judaism, not to the physical nature of the Jewish people, but to the spiritual fabric of what the Jewish people represent. How do we react? How do we respond to that? We now have a holiday, an 8-day celebration, with so many extra halachas, with more mitzvahs to do, with more Torah to learn, with more simanim and shulchan aruch that we need to master, with more gemaras and sugyas that we need to think about. This is how we counterbalance. This is how we get back for the terrible destruction that was caused in the days of the Chashmonaim, in the days of the Yevanim. And we have the opportunity, we have the schus, over the next couple of days of Hanukkah, to redouble our efforts, to rededicate ourselves, to say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to show Him that we appreciate this miracle. And the greatest way to do that, says Reb Shlomo Zalman, is to rededicate our efforts. Kavushmona simei Hanukkah Elu, to realize that the days of Hanukkah are made lehodos ulahalel, to give praise. And what greater way to praise the Ribbono Shel Olam than to show Him how much we appreciate His Torah, how much we appreciate everything about the Torah that represents our lives, the mitzvahs that we do, the experiences that we have as a community. And that is the opportunity that we're all going to have starting this Sunday evening. So I take this opportunity here to wish all of you a Freilich and Chanukah. Thank you very much for coming. It was a schus to learn together, and a wonderful day to all of you.
Someone bench? Mel, did you wash?
Sign of a number on the side. Where is the name of the Hamam Mishlo?
Thank you. Hello, everybody. How are you? Give me 1 second.